Ladies and gentlemen, members of International Doctors in AA, their wives and guests. Jerry McCracken, would you stand up, please? Let us all sing, Happy Birthday to you. Happy Birthday to you. Happy Birthday, dear Jerry. Happy Birthday to you. We all would like to extend our gratitude to the Atlanta group for this fine meeting that they've put together, for the delightful southern hospitality that's made us feel so welcome down here. My name is Jim West. I'm from Chicago. In Chicago, there's been quite a bit of resistance today. I want to cite just one example. However, it is going okay. There was a man, and this happened, whose wife was just plaguing him to do something about his drinking. Finally, the day arrived when the ultimatum occurred. She said, you do something, join AA, or I'm leaving. So by arrangements with his friends at the local tavern, he was sitting this Sunday afternoon at home, somewhat nervous, and his wife was there. And the doorbell rang, and a man showed up on the doorstep with a briefcase. And he said, hello. He said, this man said, Mr. Brown, yes. He said, I'm the man from AA. So he said, oh, won't you come in? So he said, Mary, this is the man from AA. Your name is what? Mr. Jones, okay. All right. So Mr. Jones says, who's the possible candidate for AA? And Mr. Brown said, well, I am. And he says, sit down there, please. Okay, he opens up the briefcase, and he pulls out this long form, and he says, your name, your first name, your mother's name, your father's name, your social security number, and he's giving these things off, 503-81247, and how old are you, 47, your job, I'm a foreman at the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company, and he said, all right, now we'll get down to business. He said, just how much do you drink a day? And he said, well, about a pint and a half a day. Geez, with that, he slams the book closed, and he said, what the hell, you don't drink enough to join AA. So Brown says, well, you see, Mary, that's the way it works. I did the best I could to get in, but they won't take me. Then he said to Jones, say, Jones, would you like a drink for coming over? He says, well, I'm in AA. I can only have two. That darling wife probably still thinks, geez, that's a funny outfit. But that did occur. You know, our annual meeting here is a reference point for many of us. These things occur in me. These thoughts occur in me. They are part of me, and I'm sure that I share them with you, although we don't verbalize them. This meeting is a reference point for us. It occurs annually. When I'm here, well, let's say this. When I go to an AA meeting, I feel at home. When I come to this meeting, I feel more at home. I suppose it's because I have the added dimension of being a doctor and an AA. Here we learn, well, about this group. It has a certain spirit. A certain thing lives within it, a personality. I suppose Dr. Hawkins and the psychiatrist would call it a dynamic. But anyway, it's part of my life. Then, too, we learn new and scientific things. Then we go home, and while we are busy doing these scientific and therapeutic things to people, God is getting them sober and keeping them sober, also keeping the therapist sober. I suppose our most effective and attractive therapeutic tool is our example. I would like to introduce our speaker for the evening, Mr. Tom P.
My name is Tom Powers. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to be here. On the 29th day, After my 29th birthday, I became psychotic. My trouble came suddenly. Right up to that day, I had been in all kinds of trouble. I had been having a lot of difficulties in life, but it had never occurred to me that I was heading for insanity. Different people go insane in very different ways. I went quickly, suddenly. Actually, I had been borderline and teetery for several months before, but I didn't know it, and my associates didn't know it. If you're going into manic insanity, a lot of times your associates think that's great. I had been running on 3 or 4 hours sleep a night, and then 2 or 3 hours sleep a night, and then 1 hour sleep a night. And my drinking had just settled out into something like eating. I didn't pay much attention to it. It's just something I did all the time. But I was very rarely drunk. I drank a quart of booze a day, which is about all I could stand. I weighed about 129 pounds. And just before I went to bed every night, I was not only drunk, I was stoned out of my mind, because it's the only way I could sleep. I hadn't discovered pills yet. I did discover that I could sleep well if I drank about a water glass full, spaced over 15 or 20 minutes, just before I went to bed, that would knock me over. I had to be careful getting up to bed. Sometimes I didn't quite get up, sleep in the hall upstairs because I just passed out there. And when if I woke up in the morning and my clothes were hanging on the chair, that meant I had done a fairly neat job of it. If they were all over the room, it wasn't so neat. And if I wasn't even in bed, that was a little sloppy. But I have a friend who says it's awful what you can get used to. if you jumped abruptly from the sanity of... when do we lose our sanity? Sometime around age 11, 12. If you jumped abruptly from that, where you had some buttons going and were relating to life, right, into this kind of a thing where you're drugged out of your bloody mind and still functioning, it would be a shock. But I just gradually worked into this way of life, and it didn't seem strange to me or unusual, let alone ominous or threatening. And it's some kind of God's mercy to crack. I mean, Lord knows where it would end if you didn't crack up. Psychosis is some kind of God's mercy. It was for me, and I have known some psychotics pretty well since, and it seems to me in almost every case that the dark aspects of this thing, whatever they may be, the misery, the chaos, the inability to control oneself, and finally the real break with reality, all of that is something trying to communicate a message. Trying to tell the person, you're not living right. A little while ago, I got talking to Dr. Maurer at the University of Illinois, who's a pretty smart guy. I mean, he's not only had a lot of training, but he's got a lot of intuition. He's got a lot of insight. And he had heard my story and learned my story over a period of time, and he said, I think that your drinking postponed your psychosis for about 10 years. And I'd like to use that as my point of departure because I utterly agree with him. I think drinking for me was not a problem at first and for a long time. It was a solution to a problem. And a very effective solution for a while. The problem was that somewhere in my teens, I got into attitudes, viewpoints, ways of thinking, general sets that I now know, I didn't realize when it was happening, that I now know separate a human being from what he must not be separated from. So that when I came up to 18 or 19, I was a real hurting guy. Except it wasn't running as a problem. I was used to it. And I just kind of thought everybody was hurting this way. I was ambitious. I was nervous. I was developing some personality. I was very keen to relate to people, overly keen. I was running a lot of fear, which I wouldn't have admitted if somebody said so at the time. I would have said it was high-strung, whatever. But I was scared. And booze is just what I needed. The attitudes were something that I didn't originate. I was a kind of a punk. I just let the culture roll me. I thought it was smart. First of all, I had had some kind of instruction as to what the spiritual heritage of this race is. It wasn't presented to me that way. It was just a normal religious education. They didn't overdo it in my family, but they didn't underdo it either. I had heard from a very early age that there is a one living president of this universe. And I believed it. And that in spite of evident contradictions, there was some kind of justice everywhere. And that there was a very high premium, and a necessary premium, on fair dealing, on dealing decently with your fellow human beings. That sort of thing was bred into me in no unusual way, I think in a fairly usual way. But when I got into my early teens, I fell into this thing that was going strong then, and God knows, still is all over this bloody earth, that we are too smart for all that. And I felt this as some kind of an exhilaration. I remember when it first began to dawn on me that maybe there isn't this president, this presiding, overarching omniscience. Man, that's a big turn when that ship starts shifting around. A lot of stuff shifts with it. One of the things that shocks me in this life is the burden which this president, which I have come back to believe in, permits to fall upon very tender human beings. The challenges of ages 4 and 5 with returning sanity are very clear to me now. I remember my own life in a way I never could when I was 30 years old. One of the things of returning sanity is just like clouds coming off your memory banks. Not only the events and the pictures, but the smells and the feelings come. I remember when I first stole. I remember when I first took money that wasn't my own. You think that's a small thing. It was a big thing. I remember the thrill that went with it. I remember when they came and challenged me. And I said, no, I didn't take it. And when they followed through on it, they checked the 2 candy stores where I might have spent it. And what I did was walk beyond the first one to the far one. And they checked the first one, Coudert, who said, no, he wasn't here. And I thought, oh, are they going to check the second one? And they didn't. I remember my initiation into deceit. I remember how exciting it was. I got away with it. I thought how stupid they are and how smart I am. I didn't realize there might be some other characters that would check the second one later on. But the big changes for me came in my teens when I abandoned my spiritual heritage. I abandoned the deep things about it. What men argue about in religion are not the deep things. They argue about the superficiality. You know, the whole Western church split over a superficiality. They can hardly remember what it is. Cardinal Humbert marched up the steps in Sancta Sofia and threw the document down, and it wasn't about these deep things. It was about some legality or something. Underneath all the things men have ever differed about in this area or quarreled about, there are some massive things that makes a huge difference in a human life, whether you have connections in this area or not. If there be such a president, and one is not relating to it, this makes a big difference. It began to make a difference to me. Over 3 or 4 years, I became an atheist. It felt good. It felt right. It felt advanced. It felt modern. But behind that, and behind the thinking part of it, I began to be this nervous, strapped-up guy. Because behind the abandonment of my faith in God, I began to lose. I didn't abandon this. I began to lose my faith in men and women. The teens are a real keen part of anybody's life. You begin to see things there you couldn't see before. When you're a young person, you tend to worship nearly everybody. People look big. They look reliable. Their virtues stand out large. Your mother and father are in loco Dei. They are in place of God to you. In the teens, the feet of clay begin to show. And God help a man coming up through that who isn't able to see that behind these weaknesses in human nature, there is some immense strength and some immense good. I begin to develop what in criminal country is called one-eyed vision. I begin to see very clearly with my left eye. Not literally. I begin to be very sharp at seeing what is wrong with you. And I wasn't imagining it. If you would sell out your integrity for a price, I begin to see this after I had some contact with people who were doing business. I saw that very quickly. I saw that all men lie. And I began to despise it. But I began to do it myself. I thought, well, you know, if this is the number, I'll do it. I began to go blind in my right eye. I couldn't see what every young child sees, that he is in the midst of some terrific thing here, whatever its pain may be, whatever its distortions may be. I was no longer able to see how beautiful even degenerate people are. The core of strength and hope that remains even in psychotics, sometimes very strongly in psychotics. And in ordinary people particularly, I couldn't see where they were right. I couldn't see where they were good. And I developed a kind of cynicism that wasn't a head trip. It was a gut trip. I just began to feel that way about people. At the same time, I very much wanted people. I wanted to be friends. I wanted to be in community. What happened to me is something that they had a name for 25 or 30 years ago. If you went nuts, you saw an alienist. He dealt with you when you were alienated. The extreme of alienation. Alien is a man not in his own country, not at home. I begin to be not at home in my own country. I wanted to be. It wasn't by choice. And very little of it was a head trip. There was a head trip on top of it. I did some smart talk about atheism, yickety-yak, and bull sessions, and science and all of that. Underneath it, it was a gut trip. And finally, it was a heart trip. About the time where my heart would have really got involved, though, I ran into booze. And as Maurer said, this just picked me up on the edge of where my type of life would have put me into a real crisis and given me enough pain so I might have had a chance to wake up and be some kind of a man. It doesn't mean I would have done it, but I might have had a chance. But booze solved it. Booze enabled me to live with these assumptions and to act off these assumptions that there is no God. There is nothing you could really trust in men. If you push them far enough, they'll all sell out. That the thing for any man to do in life is to find his pleasure, find his spot, make his money, enjoy his sex, get what life offers, and forget it. As a corollary to the religious going, I had long ago made up my mind that when a man died, he sure as hell died. And all these damn stories about some kind of a life afterward were the most disgusting and despicable of men's fearful imaginings. I wonder how in the hell I survived. And it was booze that enabled me to do so. It took me 2 or 3 years to learn how to drink. This is all hindsight. I didn't know this was going on. I just thought I was a sharp guy, that I was a quick man with words, and they paid money for that. And booze was very good. It took me a couple of years to learn how to take it. You know, you have to study this art. And I had a lot of physical rebellion at first. I used to throw up and puke a lot. And then, even after I kind of learned how to drink, I did a lot of tin horn drinking, just to whoop and shout and have a good time, nothing serious. But very gradually, it came to me that this was my peace. This was my strength. This was my comfort. This was my refuge. And these are names for God. This is where a man goes if he really knows what is refuge in life. Booze is an easy thing to idolize because it produces. You don't have to work. You don't have to discipline yourself. You don't have to beat your head on the floor in prayer. You don't have to go through all these motions and struggle with a lot of damned hypocrisy and separate that out and find out what's real and what isn't real in religion. You just take a shot, and man, you got peace. And you take 2 or 3 shots, and you've got the beginnings of friendship. If you're careful. If you're careless, of course, you got a mess. But again, I didn't think it out. I just slipped into it. And I must have had, not overt anxiety, but a load of it sitting right down under the threshold of awareness in my late teens. But before it ever came up and got a grab on me, I was going on this alcohol number. And I pretty soon got to the place where it was an everyday thing. And I did not consciously experience anxiety until I broke in my 29th year. I just learned how to drink. So that any time I got uptight, I got real nervous or something, I got to the booze. And you know, the booze on top of certain unpleasant things is a kind of alchemy. It just turned, oh, if I got resentful. And it was starting to get to me where it was uncomfortable. 3 or 4 drinks, and I think, well, the son of a isn't so bad after all. I still hate his guts, but I could just drift off to where it was not only tolerable, but useful. It didn't completely abort these things. It just did a kind of a mix on them. It took me about 4 or 5 years to learn how to drink well. Constantly working on it, constantly experimenting. It's not kind of like a work experiment where they hire you to do it. It's a labor of love. I mean, you're keenly interested in the results, you know. And then you have this ugly period in the morning when the bill comes due. And that's a kind of a challenge, how to deal with it. You know, I laid in a stock of various things for the eyes, murine, because I couldn't show up at the office looking too bad. Everybody looked like hell. You just shouldn't look too bad. I mean, three-quarters of the people I worked with were whooping it up the same way I was, and nobody regarded this as whooping it up. I mean, this was just living. It wasn't even a conversational piece. Everybody drank. Everybody drank hard. Oh, there was some talk about it, but not as an unusual thing. Like a lot of people who are dying or dead spiritually, a lot of people in whom the deep spring is damped down, I had a great need for assurance from the outside. Now, the best kind of assurance from the outside I ever did find, and I haven't changed my opinion, is money. I needed money, not just to pay the bills, but to get this image going and keep it going, you know. It needed certain little trimmings. The lapels had to be just right. I began to get into that little number. And to run with the rest of the crowd doing this thing, money became big for me. I had no genius for theft. My early attempts to steal were amateurish, and I never became a good thief. I've stolen all my life, but I was always clumsy at it, and I quickly saw I couldn't get enough money that way. There's only three ways to get money. You've got to steal it, inherit it, or work for it. And I didn't inherit any, and I couldn't steal it. And I saw there was no way of escaping this work number. And I thought, well, by God, if you got to work, you might as well get in and do a thing. So I began to work. And I began to make money. And I began to develop a personality off this. I drank a lot. I worked hard. I got into areas of work where I was good. Facile, not good, for God save the word. Facile, quick, snappy. I got into that section of the advertising business where there's a high premium on ideas. Ideas are an odd commodity. You're either in this area or you aren't. I found that if about two or three times a week I could come up with a real bright idea and spend two or three hours developing it, that's all I had to work. And man, I had a good time. I was around a lot. I came to work early in the morning and I left late at night so it would look good. But in between times, it left me a lot of times for visiting and wandering out and... Gee, I had a good time. I started out over in Chicago, went to Detroit, kind of a mess there. I took drunk at the wrong times. And I made a note to be very careful how I related the drinking to the work situation. Sorry to be drunk, but you mustn't get took drunk at the wrong time. You know, they speak of the wisdom of this world and it's no gag. Wisdom is skill in action. Again, it isn't a head number. It's knowing what to do at what time. And over a period of years, I got pretty good at it. I suppose the world is crawling with damn fools who are good at it this way. Nothing outstanding, but looking back on it, it's interesting. I went through a process of falling upstairs. Every time I got canned from one job, I got a better job. A drunk begins to use up his capital. You know, if he's got any luck, he starts to use it up. If he's got any energy, he starts to burn it up. If he's got any brains, he starts to burn it up. If he's got any friends, he starts to burn it up. I start to burn this stuff up usefully. It seemed to me I was going someplace. I wound up over in Cleveland. writing major accounts, having a good time, drinking more and more. I saw I was drinking more and more. I worried about it a little bit once in a while. And in Cleveland, I entered what I would call the red light area. It has nothing to do with prostitution. Well, in a way, it has a great deal to do with prostitution. Correction. It has to do with the prostitution of one's own integrity. It has to do with the school of learning how to deceive oneself. The red lights are events in one's life connected with drinking, connected with irresponsible behavior that are painful and harmful to oneself and to others. I'm not going to try to spell it out in detail. I just began to run into situations at home that were ugly. I began to see that a great part of my married life, any kind of a married life is a kind of a beautiful thing, you know? All shot through with ugliness if you're not careful. It began to have very ugly spots in it. My wife and I drank together. We got drunker than fools together. We began to get into a lot of shrieking and shouting matches. And you know what defense is, early defense against a lot of this stuff is? The funny number. You know, we begin to laugh about it. We got thrown out of a couple of apartments for shrieking and yelling at each other. And I'd wake up the next morning and I think, gee, I remember we had a hell of a fight last night, but what was it about? You know, I remember I'm supposed to be mad, but I didn't know what to be mad about. I've forgotten the whole thing. All I can remember was a lot of ugly language and shouting. So then we'd ha, 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 and try to laugh it off. One night I heard some scrambling around in the bathroom. I got up half stupefied out of bed. My wife was standing by the washbowl with a razor blade in her hand. I said, for God's sake, what are you doing? She said, well, I was thinking of cutting my wrists. And, you know, I said, come on in the front room. Let's talk about this. And I don't know, we had some conversation on the subject and forgot it. One night she fell down the basement stairs and sprained her ankle. Increasingly, we begin to have ugly stuff running with this at home. Increasingly, at work, I had to lie. I had to maneuver. I had to mount a big deceit number to conceal from everybody the fact that my drinking was intruding in my responsible area. This, to me, right up to the time I had my psychosis, was the real cutting edge of this thing for me. I let the home thing go. I just coped with it as best I could, and God knows it was poor. And in the end, my marriage didn't survive it. But at work, I was in this bind. I had to have the money in order to drink. I couldn't earn the money unless I kept this running with this same crowd, who were a money crowd. I couldn't go out and reduce my work commitment. So I always had a hell of a struggle to keep my drinking in compartmented so that I could function. And I lived that way, with the quantity going up and up and these red lights flashing. And it was in that period that I learned my lying. And the real deadly lying is the lying that one does to oneself. I had done an exterior lying number for years and was well trained at it. You know, if you're going to lie to the man, look him right in the eye and say, no, sir, I wasn't there. Don't waver. There's a whole technique to exterior lying, and you just do it mechanically after a while, and you do it good. I don't think that's the killing thing, although God knows it must be some kind of an awful burden, too. But in this period, the data were such that nobody could have ignored the fact that trouble was coming. If they had given anything like a decent look at the data. But I began to say to myself, you know, I'd be sitting in the rapid transit in Cleveland, sitting on my hands so nobody'd think I was waving at them, and a little spittle escaping here. and saying to myself, it's quite all right. You know, you're a high-strung racehorse type. These absurd lies to cover up the fact that one is in trouble, big trouble. And I begin to run it frantically and carefully and to stamp down anything in myself that would try to recognize the truth. I get down to New York in 1939, fallen upstairs again in a very responsible job, a lot more dough, a lot more of what I had come to like even better than dough, which was this prestige number, the in number, where you are in the ruling group or moving near it. I got into that in 6 months by accident. And man, I suddenly began to fly high. And it was psychosis and I didn't know it. I was drinking about a quart of booze a day. I liked my work, not just the money. And I began to work as I had never worked in my life. And I began to run something along with the booze I had not run before. I was able to think very well during the day and work very hard. And the booze just began to be for me something I took quite a lot of before I ate so I could eat. And then I would take some in the middle of the afternoon, you know, 3, 4, 5, or 6 belts so I wouldn't get too high. And then in the evening, I would take quite a bit more so that I would just level off so I could work through the evening. And then at night, I would dose myself out of my mind so that I could get some sleep. And I ran that way from early in the year, 1940, May, up into May and June. And in late June, I realized I was not in a normal state. I didn't talk much about it. I could almost get no sleep, even with heavy boozing. I was able to function at a rate I have never been able to function with since, and believe me, I've done some fancy sketching with the functioning later off amphetamines and stuff, but this manic state was something. It's very attractive. It's hideously dangerous. And in July of 1940, one afternoon, wham, I went right out the top into a manic shock. And that same day was taken to the bug house. Again, I don't know what you think about bug houses. There's a lot of criticism of them. They're not run right, so forth. But the bug house was just where I belonged. And it did something wonderfully good for me. I realized for the first time in my adult life that I was in big trouble, and it was enormously good for me. There is a kind of thing in alcoholism, there are shock episodes. In the alcoholism of anybody I've ever seen, the patterns vary. But this was the first of this kind of shock episodes for me. I was taken up to the Hartford retreat. They got one look at me. They listened to me for a while. They gave me a big squirt of something, hyoscine, I guess, in those days. And they let me go. And when I came to the next day, I was right in with the loonies. Good experiences, intense good experiences in life tend to wake a man up. Intense bad experiences will do the same thing. I remember when they were leading me in there, something said to me, this is quite all right. This is all right. And that was not the voice of my idiocy. That was this little bird of truth which I wouldn't listen to, chirping. When this disease begins to catch up with you, that's good. Whatever the details are. I don't know what would have happened in that place if I had run into AA. I actually think I might have listened. I'm not sure. But this thing shook me up enough. It broke my set. All of a sudden, I'm not the smart guy off Madison Avenue with the words. I'm the guy they're leading around by the arm from the tubs, they used tubs in those days, back to the leather vest department. And you know, I'm about 4 years old. And I'm saying, man,
You know, this is rugged. And I would be open to anything anybody would suggest to correct this.
I didn't hear anything about AA in there. I didn't hear anything about anything like AA. I got some darn good psychotherapy, and I'm enormously grateful for it, because I was out in the country where it's psychotherapy or else. You know, if you get a real loony, the answer is not AA. It's the doctor first, and never sell that short. First things first is an odd number here. And they did a beautiful job on me there. But you know, there is wisdom within wisdom. And if you're an addict, you don't need to just get your psychosis leveled out. You need to catch hold of the thread that leads out of the kind of life that makes psychosis. And that isn't a medical number. That's something else. They did a beautiful job on me. It only took them 10 weeks. Not a lot of hydrotherapy, you know, hoses playing on you and all the best stuff, and I never want to gag it and sell it short. They turned me out of there as good as new. But with the returning health came back the old ideas. The thing you have to overcome is a set of records. You know, you're carrying a regular gramophone around with you. And if you have one of these shock episodes, it wrecks your gramophone. And all you got left is your common sense. But when the health comes back, the gramophone somehow gets repaired and these old records start to play. And mine were playing full blast when I walked out of there. You know, I didn't tremble anymore. I look you right in the eye when I lied to you again. I'm right back in the old set. And back at the agency, they were waiting for me to return so the great brain could come back and make some more ideas. And man, I didn't have a dog's chance of recovery. I had recovered from the psychosis. The alcoholism, the addiction, the deep craving for the only thing you know that'll give you peace, the only thing you know that'll relax you. It is a spiritual craving. Normal people learn to get this stuff off spiritual life. It's why AA works. In AA, I've learned, to get what I was looking for in booze without paying this god-awful penalty of this hideous intoxication. I lasted about 3 weeks after I got back to work, started drinking again. Immediately, zoom, zoom, within just a few weeks, right back into the old. These patterns interest me. You can't function without patterns. You can't say, hello, how are you? Your ability to speak, these built-in mechanisms in us are blessed and gorgeous things. But when you've spent years phonying them and twisting them, that's the burden a man carries. And I went right back into these mechanics. Soon as I drank, the whole thing was going again. I was back up to a quart a day, working my fool head off, ram, 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 trying to milk my meaning out of money, trying to milk my meaning out of some kind of big shot number in business. But this time I knew it was nuts. That's a whale of a difference. And it took on a kind of an intensity. That's the worst year I have ever spent. I knew that my number was up. I knew that my routine in life led to the bughouse, and I didn't have a guess that there might be a way out. The way was lying just a year ahead on my road. I didn't know it. I hadn't heard of AA. I didn't know such a thing existed. In my wildest dreams, I never would have thought that a thing with a God number in would be of any use to me. You know, if somebody had come giving me a Jesus Christ number, oh, man, he wouldn't have got through Jesus. He never would have got to Christ. I'd have been out the door. I mean, I was that far. The amazing thing of this fellowship is the spiritual power. It bootlegs in past these mammoth semantic barriers. You know, somebody's going to talk about Jesus, let me out of here. Or God, let me out of here. But the terrific wisdom of this thing is that a guy
without anybody selling that short, a person isn't challenged in the wrong way by that here. I'm amazed at the way I got into AA. I was back in the bughouse again a year later for the same business, manic depressive psychosis. I was given 12 metrazole shocks. I was conscious in 8 of them. They don't do it anymore. They were killing 15 out of 100. It was early. They were pioneering with it. But again, that had some very good effect on me. It deeply convinced me of my need for help. And off of that hospitalization, the doctor who had me in charge there knew about AA and introduced me into AA and got me going to AA. I'm still astonished that I got in, considering the amount of heavy investment prejudice I had. I was heavily invested against religion or anything like religion. I had long ago closed my accounts in this area. I had decided that it was wise and true beyond question that this stuff was bunk. This stuff was for kids and women, not for intelligent people. That might explain to you why my marriage didn't last. It's good for laughs in retrospect, but this was deep. Behind the head trip, there is deep gut investment. If anybody said, would you like to reopen this question of religion? I say, man, don't bother me. I got a lot of trouble. Don't get me going in marginal areas. So I'm amazed at how in the fall of 1941, coming off this hospitalization, out of my, very soon after my 12th metrazole shock, I had to be carried into it. Not because I was drugged or anything. I was so scared I couldn't walk. Metrazole is chemical murder. Coming out of that, and then this doctor saying to me, you know, there's a group of people, laymen, not doctors, over here that's... He said, we don't know what to do with a guy like you. We can put you in here and probably straighten your psychosis out every year if you have to do that, but we don't know why a guy no longer psychotic, no longer in bad physical shape, as a matter of fact, in very good physical shape, will go out of here and return by choice to what he knows is insanity and death. He said, we don't understand that. But, said he, there's a group of people over in White Plains who seem to have discovered a way of helping each other, and he began to describe this fellowship to me. And there's always some kind of a grace in the picture. No matter how screwed up you are, there's somewhere, some part of you. The trick is to find your sane part wherever you're at. And that thing in me was picking up on this. And I kept thinking, well, yeah. And then he began to say, well, now I don't want to upset you, but there's a kind of a God angle with it. Oh. You know? Again, I'm amazed at how I got finessed through that. This guy didn't know my whole history. He just did it beautifully. He moved me right around. Said, well, go over and skip the religion. They tell me you can do that. He said, I don't even know if it's religion. And just go over and see if you can pick up enough of it so that you don't go crazy again. I've lost track of time. When did we start here? 30. I'm spending more time in this part of it than I usually do. I got to my first AA meeting under these circumstances, and I lump up when I try to talk about this. It isn't an emotional thing. The AA thing had something that The AA thing has a quality that I would be dead without. The AA thing had authenticity. It was real in a way that many things are not real. In my goofed up condition, I saw it was not a peep show. I saw it was not a hand club. And yet these people were lit up in a certain way. And damn it all, my hunger was and is to be lit up in that way. And I had been chasing it through, I mean, just to be alive and to be relating to people in a way, the word for which I never used anymore because I was afraid of it. These people loved each other in a certain way. If somebody had told me then that, it would have turned me off. But I saw the reality of it. These people were getting up in the middle of the night and going out and helping each other. And I never heard of anything like that. I heard of old stories of people who used to do that 600 or 700 years ago when they were nuts on Christianity. This thing was real. I began to get up in the middle of the night and do it myself. I had not done an act for years without money or personal gain of some kind involved in it. This thing was big for me. I began to get something out of this association with Alcoholics Anonymous that I hardly dared believe existed. I did a real storybook recovery in my first year here. Week after I got sober, I stayed sober. I began to go to a lot of meetings because I loved it. And then, damn it, I did a silly thing. I went crazy and top-heavy in my AA. I did an awful lot of the stuff I liked, and I tuned out the stuff I didn't like. And I happened to hit this fellowship. Gee, I don't want to blame it on the fellowship or the phase at which I hit it. But at that time, they were just coming out of a very strict phase, you know, the early phase, into a very permissive phase. They had discovered that you didn't have to push this on anybody. You didn't have to say it's your time to take a third step, kneel down. You said, well, but take it in time you want to. And I ran into a thing where I was challenged for my top-heavy activity, an awful lot of 12-step, an awful lot of meetings, no God stuff. You know, I learned you didn't have to get involved in that, so I tuned it clear out. People challenged me on that, but I never got into a hard challenge, maybe because I didn't invite it. Anyhow, I began to run a very screwy AA number, but still recovering behind it. Top-heavy with activity, top-heavy with 12-step. I mean, the big book says the 12-step will keep you sober when nothing else will, and I utterly believe it. But you can make nonsense out of the most beautiful truth on this earth. That's one of the most beautiful truths I ever heard. But you can take it and tune out the rest of the program behind it, and that's not sane. Anyhow, at the end of a year, I have tasted this beautiful thing. I have been in it. I am a member. I'm sane again in a way I haven't been for years. I'm recovering all over the lot, physically, mentally. My marriage, my life at home is beginning to look like it's reviving. My business thing is good, which it always was. The danger was I went crazy behind it. And yet, I relapsed. I failed. And it's no bloody mystery why I did. I just didn't accept at all or take in this whole spiritual number. I took the latitude that is given to people here, and it's part of the wisdom, you know, that you don't force any of this on anybody. That beautiful thing, that permissiveness, I took it and hung myself with it. I think the rules change here. Not that anybody from the outside changed. I think there's a kind of a built-in logic here. That at the end of 6 months, if you got some sanity, you're supposed to be using it in a certain way. You're supposed to be taking a deeper look at this thing. You're not supposed to be playing baby with the thing that made it easy for you the first month. You know, I just reverted to an infantile thing of mucking the permissive aspects of this program around and got drunk behind it. I didn't get drunk accidentally. I went goony enough to deliberately drink again.
on the assumption that if my drinking didn't turn out well, I could come back. I had now discovered the answer. Isn't that a great use of this thing? I think that kind of idiocy is latent in many of us and dominant in some of us. The worst things I see in AA are people who have really got in here and then somehow gone idiotic enough to boot it. There's a kind of slip that doesn't seem to be penalized that way. You know, maybe the guy, I don't want to encourage this kind of slip, but maybe the guy's around for a couple of weeks or a couple of months and something goes wrong and he gets drunk or something and then he gets back. There is a different kind of departing from this program where you know what you're doing. You lose your innocence here. You can no longer drink ignorantly if you've been a member of this, if you've been around here and really exposed for a year. Man, if you go out and use this dreadful power of free choice behind that to pick up a drink, you have used it in a new and very strange way. You know, it is one of the mysteries of the universe what voluntas is. Fiat voluntas tua. I say close, and the thing closes. I don't know. One, by means of this will, is giving commandments to a very intricate mechanism, and it's responding. That's where the illness is. And this thing removes the illness. You get your will back under control. It isn't willpower. It's just will sanity. You're in this thing. You're restored to sanity. The drink comes around, and you say no. The command goes out this way, not this way. And life and death ride on it. And I chose to go back, not under compulsion, not under obsession, not under any great need, just under a kind of what must be a very sick arrogance, and pick it up again and say, well, I'll try it. And if it doesn't work, I'll come back and have some more AA. And man, I got a lesson off that. Because I had my drunk and then got sober and got back to AA, and then I had another drunk. And that one I didn't plan. I was back where I couldn't choose again. I was back under compulsion. And I began to be sober for a week and then drunk. And sober for 2 weeks and then drunk. And sober for 2 months and then drunk. And 6 months, a year later, I see that although I still have some connection with this fellowship, I am effectively out of it. I have no more control. I have no more ability to say no when the time comes I must drink again. My pattern has changed. By this time, I knew that there is an answer here, and I knew it way down in my bones. And I kept trying real hard to get back in here. I had spells of idiocy when I'd say, well, you know, the hell with him. But then later I would say, oh no, not the hell with him. Go to that meeting. I kept going to meetings. I began to do what I should have done a long time before. This thing went on 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. In the meantime, I have entered that stage of the game, which is a totally different section of the floor show. I have turned into a drug addict. I never got onto hard narcotics. Thank God they were, somehow or another, I never got into an availability number. I've had morphine. I've had cocaine. I would be an absolute sitting duck. I love what that stuff does. What was available to me was barbiturates, amphetamines, formaldehyde, terpenhydrate, and codeine. I went sketching. I began to get a hold of anything that could change consciousness because my pattern now began to radically change. All this time, I'm going back to AA meetings. It became very bitter to go back to AA meetings. I began to hate it. Man, if you haven't had the experience of being outside of this thing, not by anyone's election but your own, but I mean really not being a member. You come in here, you know, and you've been drunk 4 days before, and nobody's looking down their nose at you, but all the paranoia in your soul is sitting right up here thinking, what the hell did they think of me? And I got to sit through this bloody meeting. I got to relate to them. I'm all right, Charlie. Oh, what a deal. I mean, it's the kind of initiation that's not comparable to coming in here the first time. It's very hard to hang on if you've got one of these failure numbers going. Not because anybody makes it hard. But paranoia, which is fear of everybody, inability to relate, is latent in everybody. And it becomes a part of this picture. You say, you know, somebody's up there talking, I think I'm a better man drunk than he is sober. You're sitting there talking this way, and this beautiful thing is going on. You know? Hank Greamy, he's dead now, God rest his soul, used to get up in front of the Chappaqua meeting and say, oh, he said, I feel so great. This is so beautiful. I'd think, you son of a bitch, I wish you'd get drunk. I hated his joy. But if you've ever had an exposure to this thing, you know that the answer is here. And it isn't a medical thing, and it isn't a psychological thing. It's a deep strain of spiritual sanity, of a clean thing at the heart and root of a person. And it's communicated not by tricks and not by gimmicks, but by simple benign infection. You catch it from other people that have got it, and you hardly know how. And the beautiful process is you just circulate. I circulated, but I didn't catch it again. And in my last year of acute insanity, and I ran out of money, I couldn't go to bug houses anymore. I had my insanity at home. My family fled, and I had it all alone. And I had a year or so when I didn't know whether I was in this world or some other world, and I want to tell you the other worlds are acutely real. I would wake up in the middle of the night and there would be three things standing there, and I didn't know they were in human shape. I didn't know whether they were a projection of my mind or something out of the world of the dead or what they were, but they spoke and acted and talked as real as you did. And then I'd get up and run out in the kitchen and see if there was any paraldehyde left. I lived that way. And in between times, I wrote radio shows. I got 2 hours of work out of myself every morning off Benzedrine. And that was nuttier than anything that ever happened in the nut house. And out of that, I think that kind of lesson only comes to a certain type of person. I think it comes to a person who is deeply, insanely arrogant. I think the disease within the disease is this bloody choice, well, I'll do it my way anyhow. And I think the lesson, not out of any punitive design in the universe or the president of the universe, I think it just has to be that way for some of us. I finally learned my lesson off that. I didn't know I was learning it. I just know that in 1946, Easter Sunday, I got taken to the hospital for the last time. I didn't know it was the last time. I had DTs for 5 days. They couldn't give me enough chloral to stop it. And they turned me out of there, and I went home and had some more DTs. But somewhere in there, I submitted. I don't know how I did it. Something turned over in me. For years, people had said, Powers, you're fighting it. You haven't surrendered. And I used to think, what is this? Do I have to write out a statement of surrender? Do I get a sword and hand it over? How do you surrender? I never could make any sense out of it. All of a sudden, these bloody walls begin to go down in me. And I, behind that, in my first weeks after that hospitalization, saw some things I had heard a lot about around in here and had never been able to take in. Whether wouldn't or couldn't, I still don't know. The line between defiance and inability is a very tenuous thing, and a man is a poor diagnostician of his own insanity. I don't know. I just know that I was separated from things in this fellowship which are of the utmost importance through an inability to comprehend words like surrender. long before the turn came, for a couple of years, I had been open to the God thing. I had been making little peeping efforts at prayer. Somewhere in there's a thing which the Buddhists call the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. Something happens to a man, and the doggone thing just swings around. And all the rest of it follows. What was a big argument and a struggle for me before, all of a sudden it began to make sense. Well, yes, if there were, I don't know whether there is or not, but if there were some kind of a spirit which was to this universe as I am to my body, well, and I were a cell in the body, yes, I should relate to this. I should take orders. It began to make sense. I wasn't into faith yet. I just began to think, well, maybe. The whole ship began to swing around. I wasn't sure it was swinging. I kept thinking, oh, Lord, is this another false start? I tortured myself with that. But it wasn't. The swing came. I think this is absolutely the most precious thing that can happen to a human being. A lot of human beings seem to be able to live their whole life and not go through this kind of a crisis. I don't know what that's all about. I don't know what precedes human life. I don't know what follows it. But I know there's a certain class of people, and I'm now in a room full of them. If you're an addict, if you're a hard narcotics person or a lush, you're in this country. Something at this depth has got to turn around, and this is not a new idea. This is what they were talking about in the first years of AA. This is what they got, why William James was so important to them, that it lies below psychology. That we have got this body-mind thing. We have tuned out what men have always known as a reality. There is a depth deeper than the mind. Something turns in there. And the whole beautiful thing follows that. And I wouldn't know how to tell another human being how to do it. It isn't something you do, although you cooperate. It's something that occurs in this culture. AA is a culture. A culture is a surround in which an organism could live that couldn't live otherwise. If you put a certain kind of organism in a culture, it will live. That's the position we're in. And I survived long enough with being an organism with very little vitality for this kind of life, with almost nothing to start with. I look back on it now. I used to think, why did it take me so long? Now I think, I wonder, how did it happen so soon? Dr. Fox was talking about these people who are deeply twisted. For some of us who are deeply twisted, it's amazing that this thing works as soon as it does and as well as it does. Some great, terrific thing is going on here. We are all the custodians of it. And anyone who will come in here needing it with some kind of a minimum ability to stay, I don't mean cooperate, just get the body here. And through all the insanity or whatever kind of failure you have to subject yourself to, the only thing that saved my life was staying in the culture. If I had departed from this culture, I don't dare think of it. This thing kept me alive until my real life would come again. And then in all the years since, I haven't any words to say what recovery is meaning to me. If I live to October, it will be 22 years. It's been an incredible time. This thing that Dr. Fox put on the board this first 3 years, gee, did that speak to my condition. I think it's terribly important to realize that coming into AA and getting sober is not the end of anything. It's the beginning of something. It's the beginning of a kind of life. The human race has been taught this for 5,000 years. Our records, we can't pick it up ahead of that. But this, men have been more concerned with this than anything else. War, money, love, conquest, comfort, you name it. This thing has held humanity. I've been reading history recently. Read it again. This runs through it all. This is what everyone is looking for, except the price is high. And all of the traditions say that only desperate people can attain to it.
Thank God for our desperation.
Let us close this with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.